Today's episode is a two-parter, the first of which is an interview with Lee Webb, who has a new story on the Storyteller Vault called Dead Reckoning, and it is 50 pages of Society of Ether goodness. If you have no interest in fiction or Storyteller Vault stuff, jump to about the six-minute mark, where Josh Heath and I talk about recommendations on how to run a Mage of the Ascension one-shot, and how to run one-shots and con games in general. If you're hearing this before Sunday, May 16th, there's likely a few slots still available for TriotCon, which is the online convention that I and a number of other podcasters are putting on that is happening the weekend of May 14th through 16th. And you can go to TriotCon.com for more information or click on the show notes. And with that, on with the show. My guest today is Storyteller Vault author and Discord meme lord, Lee Webb. You wrote an interesting product that is now available on the Storyteller Vault. What's the title of it and what is it?
Well, the title is Dead Reckoning, and it is the sequel to a story I wrote in an anthology that came out last year called Darkened Streets. The story in that was called Fireball Run.
And where does the story take place? Like, what is the setting of it?
This is going to be a series about the Society of Ether and around North Texas.
Interesting. And it takes place within the World of Darkness?
Yes, yes. I view this as somewhere in between the Revised Era and the M20 Era. I am not planning on setting down exactly when this happens, but...
What got you into writing Mage of the Ascension fiction?
I was listening to this podcast, and somebody said there wasn't a lot of it on the vault, and I thought, I can do that. I can put the words together. I can make, a story about the Society of Ether. I'm going to do this. And I did.
So why pick the Society of Ether?
At the time, I had been playing one for the first time. I had been saving it for a special occasion, and I had a whole lot of stuff in my brain about them.
What are some of the things within the story that a fan of Mage of the Ascension World of Darkness may recognize and go, oh, that's a mage thing?
I focus very much on the Society Ether and the way they look at things. Hypertech, mad science, ether tech, strange technology, crazy energy effects, railguns.
Who do you feel the target audience is, and like, do you feel that there is a clear genre to your work?
I like to view what I'm writing as an action comedy with that dips into other genres. Mostly, I am trying to make people laugh and have a good time and have some feels.
Is there a core protagonist? Is it an ensemble? Like, who do we follow in the action of the story?
In Fireball Run, I had the ensemble cast. I had several characters, and you didn't know who was going to make it to the end. And then I had three characters, main characters, left over at that. And that was Minerva Featherstone, Albert T. Edison, and Dwight Cogson. And those are going to be the three characters I'll be following going forward.
And what's a thumbnail sketch of those characters?
Well, Minerva, first off, was created by my wife. She was a character she ran several years back. And she is a very odd character. She's very analytical. She's very up in her own head. And she practices a lot of strange biology. She's working on basically a way to turn algae into solar power. Coincidentally, stuff that sleepers can use. She's very focused on this being available to people. She's not trying to do something crazy there. She's trying to be beneficial. And Albert just wants to make crazy inventions that go boom. He is a junkyard wizard. He throws his stuff together out of whatever's lying around. He very much MacGyver. I think the original idea when I was putting him together was, what if Gus from Lonesome Dove was a Society of Ether member? And I ran from there. Dwight is the least developed of the trio, and his story will be coming along after I do something with Albert next.
How long is this piece?
Runs about 50 pages, but they're squished up so they're easy to read on the phone. As far as how long the entire thing is going to be, I'm thinking about 6 to 10 stories with a whole bunch of stuff I'll throw in the meantime, because once the ideas start coming, they don't stop.
This I understand. And what got you into writing fiction?
Oh, many, many years ago, back when we were communicating on bulletin boards and through email chains, I was a member of the Evangelion fanfiction mailing list, and I wrote a bunch of crazy stories back then. Some of them are available on fanfiction.net. Some of them are lost to the void.
If we are looking for this story on the Storyteller Vault or DriveThruRPG, what should we search for? We will also be including a link in the show note, but...
The new story, Dead Reckoning, which is about Minerva trying to follow up on events that happened in the previous story, is called Dead Reckoning, and it is right there on the Storyteller's Vault under that. The previous story, Fireball Run, was in Darkened Streets, and it is also available on Vault.
And we will include links to both of those. And just so people know what kind of investment you're asking for, how much does Dead Reckoning cost?
$250. It is a short story. I'm not asking for more than that.
Anything else that you'd like to leave our audience with, or any other teaser recommendation or call that you would like to put out into the world?
I would like people to check out Darkened Streets. There was a lot of good stories in there. I was very happy and pleased to be part of it. It got me started on all this. So if I want to recommend anything, it's that.
And that link will be in the show notes as well. That was a staff pick on Drive-Thru. So that certainly says something. And I look forward to seeing more fiction in the world of Mage. If somebody is listening and saying, hey, I'd like to write a short story or a Mage story or something like that, do you have any recommendations on where they should start?
First thing you need to do is have a few characters in mind and throw them into a situation, watch what happens, and then write it down.
Lee, thank you so much for talking with us today.
It was a lot of fun. Thank you for having me.
Hi, Mage fans. This is your host, Terry Robinson, with co-host Josh Heath, and today we are talking about how to do an one-shot. This is being done with the idea that Try It Con, that Josh, Chaz, Victor, and I are actively working on, is in the not too distant future. And we were hoping to mildly arm the GMs that raise their paws saying, I will participate in your strange event with the wisdom and knowledge to go forth and do slightly better than maybe they thought they would. Josh, how you doing?
I'm doing really well, Terry. And for folks that haven't looked at Try It Con yet, you really need to, because it's going to be a really fun event where we're trying to get people to try things they have not tried before. Play a game you haven't played before. Interact with people you haven't interacted with before. Or hang out with your friends playing a game you haven't played before. In the end, try something new. That's the whole idea behind it.
Before we get into the how-to section, I think the one super piece of advice I have for an online convention consists of bring a friend.
Yes.
I'm excited to try a game at Try It Con. I'm super excited that one of those games is going to be me and Josh playing Star Trek. So it's just going to be like, who can redshirt the other person first? And that is a completely different RPG experience than if I were to plunk down at Gen Con with the Borg cube in front of me. It becomes a very different and equally legitimate and probably more fun game, but that's just me.
I'm with you.
And the other thing is, this thing's real cheap. We're charging $2, $1.69 of that goes towards the overhead of running it, and everything else goes to the Helen Keller Foundation, which is an organization that fights blindness mostly in sub-Saharan Africa by ensuring access to nutritional supplements. My vague RPG justification was that was, you can't play RPGs if you can't see. I just think it's a good cause, and it is remarkably efficient, and literally every dollar of the first 1500 that we take in, I am matching to do it, so that is kind of our charity good works angle. I know a few of our GMs have also earmarked any session fees that they take as going towards a cause of their choice. And within the next 2 weeks or so, I think we have some interesting things coming out. We've partnered with Onyx Path for certain values of partnered with. They know we exist and will be participating. But the other thing I like is we have 45 sessions, and there is no system that has more than 3 sessions of it being run.
Right.
Do you have a favorite game on the list that you're like, oh man, we're offering that?
We're offering Star Trek Adventures, which mm-hmm. other than Aberrant and other than World of Darkness stuff is my other big love and the game I've been playing a lot during the pandemic. I'm running in 2 different Star Trek Adventures games, and maybe we'll be running my first one, not at TriotCon, but for another thing soon. So it's definitely like my big gaming love at the moment. So I'm excited for that.
I'm super thrilled that Chaz Kellner of The Story Told and Fall of Jara is running Wanderhome at like 8 a.m. on a Saturday, and it filled like immediately, and I'm like, yes, do it. I'm also thrilled that someone is running a Exalted 1E Alchemicals game that is going to just be this 6-hour alchemical superhero brawl event where you try and change something, like prevent a city from being destroyed on the inside of Autochthon.
Which he's described as Transformers in Exalted. If you're a Transformers fan, you should check out this Alchemicals game.
I sometimes wish that the old World of Darkness had that kind of design space. I mean, Mage gives you that opportunity every once in a while, but Exalted is just like, we're going to lean into it.
Right.
And yeah, I mean, there's a Dark Ages Fae game, which I'm like, oh, if it weren't 7 hours in the middle of me doing 9 other things, I would also be participating in that. But I'm jazzed to see what's actually going to turn out. Again, event fees are $2 and almost all the games are $7 or less. And that $2 badge fee covers all of our overhead, as it were. And with that, so Josh, what's a one-shot?
A one-shot is a contained game of some form. So you've got a set amount of time, 3 to 6 hours, say, we are going to play this one game, this one story, and that's it. That is a one-shot.
When you do a one-shot, are there any like types of one-shot that you do?
So for me, I try to focus on the full story arc, or like a full session of a one-shot, where it's like, this is an A, B, C of a story. And that's my hope in a one-shot, is that's what you're going to get. You're going to get a contained story that ends. Because if it doesn't end, then we have to run another session, and that destroys the one-shot plan.
Yeah. Magpie does 2 shots, mm-hmm. which I think is kind of an interesting way to do things. Yeah, I think the one-shots I have participated in kind of fall into a few buckets. One is what I refer to as the quick shot, where it is less than a full arc, often significantly. It may be something where you literally give someone a character sheet and say, okay, you're about to fight the dragon, go. And the idea is that is a session that takes 1 to 2 hours. That is, I need to kill time between these two other events, and you get a smattering of system. You get to feel like a badass. You have nothing approaching closure. At the end of that 1 hour, that dragon may not be dead, or you may not have been fully defeated, but that is really a quick taste. That is something that you generally see at pop culture conventions, where gaming is just one of the streams. It's often done a lot with board games, where you will have 4 board games that this publisher is doing, and every hour you rotate through to another game, even if you haven't finished yet.
Yeah, they're also called demos a lot of the time, okay. where a company will say, hey, I want you to test out our game. So we're going to give you a really limited scenario that you're going to demo, and then walk away going, oh, I kind of understand what Vampire 5th Edition looks like, because I played it for an hour at, for example, PAX Unplugged, and that was like that limited contained experience of it that I had, which is helpful for playtesting as well.
Oh, yeah. And you will often have a limited power set. Maybe the character sheet is simplified. And also, you may almost be able to physically feel the developer pushing you in the back to keep the game moving, whether you want to or not. Like, I want to luxuriate my character's experience of their first spring outside of their haven. They're like, I can't hear you over the sound of the kaiju that you need to defeat.
Right.
So, yeah, I'm not going to quite say there's a gun to your head, but you're encouraged to move along. Another type that you occasionally experience is some games, character creation is so vital to the game that they want you to do it at the table. This happens a lot with games that have a streamlined but customizable form of character creation. Almost every PBTA game I've ever played, you did character creation at the table, because there is also a part of character creation where you're trying to establish your group dynamic of some way, shape, or form. When I run Blades in the Dark, we do character creation. Character creation can be done ahead of time, but like the crew creation is done together. And hopefully the system that does that is flexible enough that the storyteller can come up with a story on the fly based on that. And usually it's a case where the group fits into 1 of 4 or 5 lanes, and they have different ways of adjusting for that. There are also some other ones that I have run into. Does that cover kind of your basic experience, or are there any that you have done that are fundamentally different?
Yeah, the other thing that I want to say about the character creation element is that sometimes a storyteller will come in with a character sheet that's about 80% done, or maybe 90% done, and say, hey, spend the freebie points that you have in the way that you want to, which is great for players that know the system already, but can be really time consuming if you don't have players that know, particularly Mage, already. Mm-hmm. So that can be a fun way of doing the slight character adjustment at the table.
Why should people run a one-shot? And then more specifically, why should people run a Mage one-shot?
I think people should run Mage specifically because it's flexible as a world. It's really engaging. It's a deep setting that's designed to instigate personal, emotional reflection on the nature of reality. So it's deep, but you can really do a lot with it in a small amount of time, where you can get people into a moral quandary and say, figure it out. And yeah, you've got magic to figure out this moral quandary. So that's why I think Mage, and then in general, a one shot, because you get to finish a story. There are so many storytellers out there who are like, I never get to finish my games because they're these epic long, like years long campaigns. And it's like, if you run an intentional arc of a one shot, it's over. And you can be like, yeah, I finished my story. Good. I'm good to go.
Yeah, for me, I think one shots are important because I think we undersell the degree to which playing the damn game is the best way to start playing the damn game. Like at a large convention, I will try generally to play 6 to 8 sessions. At a meet space convention, those are generally 5-hour sessions. In virtual, there tend to be 3 to 4, which I think is perfect. If you're like, I can't sit down and GM for 4 hours, if you have a tight story, you can do it in 2.5 to 3 hours if you're willing to push the gas pedal. And I really think a lot of game books are sold because they have an interesting cover or you like the author behind it. I reflexively buy everything with Fred Hicks' name on it, and I'm kicking myself that I somehow managed to not buy a copy of Thirsty Sword Lesbians. I even told other people that I was backing it because it was Fred Hicks and not because it was Thirsty Sword Lesbians, and somehow I completely failed. So people buy the book based on the premise, the cover art, the authors, but people play the game because they've had something to suggest that there is an engaging experience there. And it may not seem efficient because it's going to take you 5 hours to run 5 people through the game, but that boots on the ground proselytizing is really what makes a game community hum. And so you are helping the community for the game you like by running that one shot. In addition to that, as a storyteller, it is a boot camp.
Yeah.
I have run the same one shot, I think a little bit shy of 24 times at this point. So assuming 4 players a go, I mean, that's a little bit less than 100 people I have personally introduced to Mage at the cost of roughly 1 hour per person. And it has given me so much information of how to deal with people who are uncomfortable with the system, how to deal with people who have different RPG styles, what are the things that people encounter in Mage that does not make sense for them. It really forced me to put my money where my mouth was and saying that this is a great game that everyone should try. And it has made me super feel that that is a statement I can stand behind. Why Mage in particular? I like that it gets to subvert a lot of World of Darkness tropes. There was a Facebook thread where people were talking about crossover and the difficulties of theming and such. And someone's like, I don't know if I want the dark, broody reflectiveness of a vampire chronicle ruining the core experience of the World of Darkness, which is Akashic martial artist kicking the heads off of cyborgs. I really think that it ruins the true purpose of the World of Darkness. I'm paraphrasing, but I'm like, just in Mage, the way you get to do stupid shit and the way it's built into it, it's kind of like in Werewolf, that first time that you get to roll 15 dice. Like, Werewolf is one of the few games where you get to roll an exalted of dice.
Right.
And Mage lets you do that. Also, mages are human. They are liminal. They get to encounter the weird in ways that other people can't. So I love doing that. I am also constantly amazed at how quickly, when you say all magic is real, people are able to jump on that and run with it. It is something that takes up 60 pages in the core rulebook. But when you just say all magic is real and give them a little prodding in the game, so many people are able to just run with it. About 15% of people are like, I don't get it. That's fine.
And for those folks, you'll be fine.
Yeah.
You'll be fine because the experience there is going to be, hey, what is a neat thing you want to see happen here? And if you can get that person to think of, oh, I would like X, Y, and Z to happen, you can say, here are the ways you can use the tools you have to make that fun thing happen.
When you run a Mage one shot, what kind of games have you run? I know you've run a couple.
Yeah, I tend to focus on, again, the philosophical or moral quandary as like my kernel of this is how I'm going to start it. But then I also am a little railroady where I kickstart something intentionally and say, hey, you are going to be in a haunted house. And this haunted house is going to push you along as the story goes, through the house. And things will happen and you have to make choices around it. For a one shot, that is okay. You'll be fine as a storyteller doing that, because people expect some pushing to get through the story that you have provided to them. This is one of the few times I'm all about it's okay to railroad your players, because if you don't, they'll probably go off and do their own thing. And that's okay too, but it's going to be a different experience for a one shot if you let them do that.
Yeah. And I think it is something that players should be more accepting of, as I'm fond of saying, which is apparently something I thought I picked up from Monica, but Chaz claims I picked up from Chaz, which I think they both picked up from something on yet another podcast. You're not railroading players so much as that you're giving them tickets to get on the plot bus. Right. And if you want to get to the top of Mount Plot, you need to be at the bus station at this time. If you want to spend 90 minutes exploring the world, that's fine as long as everyone's on board, but it's going to be the equivalent of eating a lot of cotton candy. It may be tasty in the moment, but you're not going to be satisfied in the long term.
Yep, exactly.
But what specifically, like, kind of scenarios have you run?
Oh. So one thing that I did as one of my early mage one shots was a bar, which sounds like, oh, it's classic D&D trope, but I had all the players in a bar talking about their paradigm, and then had elements of the world of darkness appear or interact with them in the bar as a way of them working through how their paradigm would explain that thing, which sounds like a really weird kind of esoteric way of running a game, but I have had a lot of fun with it, where you have a marauder show up, like everything changes and everything looks like a fantasy setting or whatever for a few moments, and then they have to kind of explain, work through, like mess with what is occurring around them. And then it disappears. And then they're back in the bar. And then they have to go, okay, do we follow that? Do we chase it down? Or do we just sit back down with our beers and continue drinking? And I love the different directions that tends to make things go. I also have run a familiars or consorts game, which I did at Gen Con. And I loved it because the basic idea was your mages have gone missing, go find them. But it became this philosophical like digression into who am I and what am I, which was amazing. And I have made lots of friends from that adventure.
Yeah, that's the only one shot, I think, where everyone like cried and exchanged information so they could send each other Christmas cards at the end of it.
Yes. I am now like really close friends with at least one of the players, and like fairly good friends with another one of the players. And I had never met them before that, and didn't think I was ever going to see them again. But they like tracked me down on Facebook. So
yeah, but here we are.
Yeah.
The one shot I run is called Justice Ascendant, and it takes place in Philly. And the idea is some bad people who did possibly some bad stuff are in Philly basically for a 3-day weekend. And your goal is to track down as many as you want. But the key thing to bring in Josh's angle of the moral consideration is each one has committed various crimes. One person has consumed basically an umbral praetor, which is not something that is a mortal crime, but the people who think that that person is important are really pissed at them and will give you a lot of money if you're able to take down the person who consumed Jillamothica, the Ever-Dying. Another person has killed a bunch of bygones, which is also something that mortal law doesn't care about, but a lot of people are like, you killed a unicorn, you're going down, fucker. Another person has a death cult, and another person was trading in artifacts and repatriating them. And the first thing the group does is, which of these are actual crimes? So that has been interesting in a era where police violence is generally a thing that recurs on consent forms as a thing I don't want to have in my game. And I'm like, you get to be the police. Are you okay with that? They're like, oh yeah, I'm going to drop some pain. I'm like, is this a metaphor? But the first thing they get to do is choose who they want to consider, try and figure out what their character justifications on that are, and then go do it. So we've outlined kind of some of the sessions that we've run. I think it is hard to talk about a mage one shot without talking about magic, because that's what a mage does. How do you present the freeform magic system in a one shot?
Yeah, so the easiest way is to give every player three tricks or three rotes that they can do and say, hey, these are the things you can do, particularly useful when you're not actually playing a mage in a mage one shot. Like my familiars game, you can just say, these are the powers you have. But you can do it really easily with mages and just say, here are your rotes. they do this. And then if you want to be creative in the moment, let me know and we will work that out. I also put a parameter around that where I say, you have a minute to tell me what you want to do. And then we will figure out how to do it mechanically in a minute. Mm-hmm. Because in a one shot, you need to control your time. I put those parameters on it, and then I'm flexible because some people are hard at like a minute, mm-hmm. but you give them a set amount of time so they start thinking about it ahead of time and then going, okay, this is what I want to do. And it helps you speed things along. What about you, Terry? How do you get that rolling?
I have two things. One, I provide to the players, if they want, a sphere quick reference. Mark Hope on the forum, on the Mage Facebook group, created a free one in the style of the second edition quick reference, which is just a page per sphere. If you want something more detailed with more information, for $1.99, friend of the show Charles Siegel did one creatively, I think entitled The Spheres of Magic. Link will be in the show notes. That's $1.99. If you ask Charles nicely and say you're doing a one-shot, Charles may let you pass that around to players. But regardless, you can either say, hey players, you may have a much better time if you try this, if you want to do the freeformy part of the freeform system. I start the session with a few descriptors on how to do common magical effects with the spheres. Mm-hmm. I explain how to fireball. And I also use that as an example of how to explain the difference between vulgar and coincidental, as we talk about the standard gas main breaking or car gas tank exploding versus I am literally going to summon lightning, teleportation, and other things. It's remarkable how many spells in D&D are all just three-dot mage effects.
Right. The interesting thing with that is I actually hold the vulgar and in a coincidental conversation to my chest,
okay,
until it comes up in play.
Okay.
And then I will say to the player attempting to do the thing, I'll say, here's a thing about the system for you to know. You may do that, but there is this force of the universe that will push back at you if you attempt to do so, called paradox. So you may do that, but know that the universe will push back on you. Would you like to continue with that action? Mm-hmm. And either they'll say, yes, of course, I want to cast a fireball. It's a one shot. Or they'll say, oh, maybe not. Maybe I'll hold back a little bit. And I'll be like, okay, let's figure out a way to do it that is coincidental in that situation.
I give long lists of rotes comparatively, and I try and make sure the rote names are very descriptive. Entropy 3 is break device and other such things, and it's pretty straightforward what they do. I appreciate things like Rip the Man Body and Body of Light and so on because they have a cool name. And vampire powers kind of go into the same thing, like Slip Lethe's Grasp and so on. You're like, what the hell does that do? Right. We're going to need a description. Part of the reason I list so many powers is my goal is to show that mages are powerful. When I build characters for a one-shot, I generally make them Arete 4 characters with like maybe 12 dots or 9 dots overall, because like part of the fun of mage to me is feeling powerful. In a regular game, that would be what is technically known as narts, but these people have no system mastery. So you right. make up for that. Like someone who, a new character who is being played by someone with 2 years of experience with mage, I think is just as powerful as someone with 2 more dots of Arete and 6 more dots in spheres who has no familiarity with the Gaver system. Occasionally I will get someone who is super familiar and just hasn't played before. And I will generally ask that player to tone it down because otherwise they kind of turn into some juggernaut-esque character.
See, maybe, but maybe not, because yeah. I think there's an opportunity there when you have that player to just be like, to all the other players, see, you could be doing that if you want to.
Yeah.
And then, you know, see how that affects the table.
Yeah. Your brother's becoming a doctor. Why can't you do something good with your life? I do make a few small modifications to the magic system. I tend to make single sphere effects a little bit easier to do. In the fact that, like, oh, you want to do that thing to an object and have it stick around, I'm not going to require matter 3 and such like that. There, it is important to me that your game know what the game-breaking effects are. If you're going to do a high-power game, Correspondence 4 just changes the game. Yep. Mind 4 just changes the game to me. There are just some things that will fundamentally change how the game is done. Another thing I do is I ignore auras. One, because I hate auras as a concept. And two, one of the things that can very much paralyze a one-shot is everyone always using one-dot effects all the time. Especially if you're used to D&D where everyone's like, I'm going to see if there are any traps. If the players have the appropriate thing, I will just tell them that, like, look with your special eyes and see the following. Are there any other modifications that you make to kind of the gamer system to just keep it moving?
One thing that I will do is give people juice of some form. You know, there's quintessence in the system, but I'll usually just be like, everyone's got 10 quintessence.
Mm-hmm.
Just whatever, doesn't matter what your avatar rating is or whatever, you've got 10 quintessence that you can use. You've got magic juice points, because that helps people be like, oh, I now know how this works in the system, and I've got this cool juice power that helps me do things,
mm-hmm.
which again encourages people to do the thing. You want them to feel like, I need to do the thing, so that they can have fun with the game that you're giving them.
Yeah, and it gives kind of a get out of jail free card. The fact that mages are so squishy, a mage to me benefits from their ability to avoid direct physical confrontation or to instigate it with overwhelming force.
Right.
I'm also a big advocate of the drive it like you stole it camp of play. Josh gives quintessence. I give generally 3 or 4 points of willpower as opposed to the full thing, because otherwise 40 points of willpower among 5 people, you could do a lot of damage with that. I generally don't use paradox. I will explain what paradox is, but anything that generates paradox, I will have manifest immediately.
Yes, exactly.
I want them to see that mages are weird and uncontrollable.
Particularly in a one-shot, just do the thing and have paradox immediately bite them. Like, any paradox points have caused something, because it creates a fail forward or, oh, wow, this is something weird happening moment. And it's a one-shot, so players aren't going to get scared by it. They're just going to be like, I'm going to deal with that whenever it happens.
Yeah. And when you're doing vulgar magic, that one dot of paradox is, I manifest as a small inconvenience. So the player who just decides to fireball, your clothing light on fire. That is something that you can do. It will take probably an action to deal with. The person who uses a vulgar life effect starts sneezing uncontrollably, which gives away their position. Little things like that. The goal is to have little complications rather than just like having a full-on paradox backlash or something like that. But something that will have them notice it, where it is very clear that there is a benefit to them doing that magical effect, but there is a cost, because mage doesn't have magic points that you need to build up, or mana that you need to expend.
I never cause damage from paradox backlashes. Mm-hmm. Like, and I think you were sort of hinting at that, like, don't do that here, because you're just going to kill your characters, and that's not helpful for them continuing in the story. It's a great time for, hey, weird, silly, strange things happen.
And you can make it time limited, where you're like, oh no, this paradox backlash I introduced is becoming more of a problem than I anticipated. The magical fire goes away after 3 turns. You stop sneezing. The imp that was summoned is gone. The cops that noticed what you were doing have decided to move on, or something like that. Mage is weird, and I think you're allowed to lean on that. So we've kind of talked about the magic side of it. What about the setting? Like, what does the world of darkness look like in a one-shot for you?
I hyper-focus my settings for a one-shot. The world of darkness is huge. There is so much you can do, so many places you can go, not even counting the Umbra. If you just look at the physical world, you can do everything. Pick a place and stick to it in a one-shot. Don't have your players world hop unless you have a way of controlling it in a one-shot. Pick a place, stick to it, run the story there. That's my main setting suggestion for a storyteller.
Yeah, for me, the big thing is that if the players have a notion of the world of darkness, try and establish heads on what you want the theme of your world of darkness to be. I think that the world of darkness of Mage needs to have notes of defiance and hope to it, unless you're doing a game where it's like, oh, your chantry is in winter and you are dealing with 400 years of paralyzing politics. I really think that theme and mood need to be front and center. And the more you can point to it, even if you literally call it out, I think is kind of important, that the world either has your back or doesn't have your back, or you're the good guys. Or it could be a case where your goal is to say, mages in the world of darkness deal with unseen threats and horrors, and they are never recognized for it, except for maybe by their own people. And that is where the darkness of the world of darkness comes in, that you have done this great heroic thing that no one except for the 3 other people who do this with you will ever be recognized, and you are the sole survivor. And the only recognition you will get is you went from a T3 to a T4 or something like that. So kind of establish what you want your world of darkness to be. I make the world of darkness identical more or less to our world, except for I add that supernatural element on top and make it so that all the supernatural elements kind of cancel each other out. Right. So the technocracy prevents the Ventru from taking over city government or the planning board, which is attempting to be run by the Nefandi so they can move a ley line, is also incurring the wrath of a Garu sept that really wants to keep their cairn centrally located or something like that. So I created this very kind of tense world, but with more weird stuff around the peripheral. Like there are a lot more ghosts and so on.
It is really helpful to decide what your NPCs are up front, not just what NPCs you will use in the story, but what canon NPCs exist in your setting that may be there for players to interact with. Particularly helpful if you've got people that are playing that know the game, but maybe not be experts on it, but have read a lot of Mage or a lot of the World of Darkness, and they're like, ooh, I'm really excited to know that Vormos, Eater of Souls, is in this story. For one of my one-shots, Vormos, Eater of Souls, was one of the figures that the familiar was connected to. And they were like, really? And I'm like, yeah, this is a one-shot. We can do that. And they were super excited to be like, I'm connected to Vormos, Eater of Souls. Use those bits and pieces in a one-shot. This is the time to have Porthos show up, or Dante to show up, or someone else in the setting that you're like, I'm super excited about them. Bring them in here. Just do the thing.
Yeah, I think any game where you get to drop the title Vormos Grand Harvester of Souls, it kind of just like elevates things a little bit. You're like, okay, I'm playing a game. There's a guy with the title Grand Harvester of Souls. That implies a lot. I almost go the exact opposite direction of I strip away all the canon NPCs. I don't even have a world with traditions. Like when I make characters, when I make pregens, like people are like, oh, this character is totally a blah blah. If they're familiar with the game, I'm like, is it though? And it is very important to me to have characters that do not fit that mold. That is partially because I am evangelizing for the idea that tradition does not equal paradigm. I like that. If you are dealing with someone who is a setting genius, either set up the expectation that you are not using the default setting, or say if you're going to do something that depends on knowing something already about the setting, tell me. There's remarkably little evidence within the World of Darkness that says that the World of Darkness all takes place in the same universe. We have information about werewolves in the Mage books. There's nothing to say that the werewolves in the Mage books are the same as the werewolves in the werewolf books.
Exactly.
And I'm a big fan of running with that. If you want to make the werewolves in your game things that literally kind of go nuts when there's a full moon out, or make your vampires allergic to garlic, that's fine. Like, again, it's your game. It's your one shot. Go nuts with it. You may want to include a disclaimer at the beginning, because one of the side effects of the metagaming that occurs in a one shot, using your awareness of the system and setting to kind of keep things moving forward and to make better choices, is that players may make assumptions based on that. Just try and state that up front. If anyone gives you crap, I recommend you go to the Fractured Cosmos section of the book Ascension, or just look me up in Discord and I will appear in your game to give a very short dissertation about that notion.
See, I think that's fine. I actually usually take the opposite tack, where I say the World of Darkness exists as the books are written. And if a player is like, I know the Tremere are blah, 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 and Salubri and Salat this and blah, 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 and the Bonars. And I'm like, if you feel that is helpful to metagame that knowledge in a one shot, fine. You'll be fine doing that. Like, that is an okay time to just allow it. In a regular chronicle, I'm usually like, please don't do that. And I signpost, these are my setting changes early. In a one shot, I roll with that because I'm like, if a player is bringing that knowledge, that helps them have fun here. Let them do it.
I appreciate that. I will not do it, but I appreciate that.
Fair.
So what do you do, if anything, to kind of streamline the rules, or any other recommendations you have to keep the darn thing moving?
Yeah. Combat, take most of combat and throw it out. And I say that kind of loosey-goosey, but combat in World of Darkness is really tough in that it takes a lot to do it correctly. If you do reverse initiative order and have people declare actions and then go back up to the top and blah, 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 and do the whole things that you're supposed to do, rules as written, keep combat to one roll if you can, and roll with that most of the time. That is like my very first, like, this is a system, massive system change, is I try to just have all combat be one roll or a contested roll in most cases.
I completely skip initiative. To me, it's generally going to be obvious who gets to act first. Either the players are ambushed, or the characters are ambushing someone else. Like, very rarely is somebody having a countdown going like 3, 2, 1, fight. And then we need to establish initiative. I also do initiative order in order of who has an idea. That way it's like, anyone know what they want to do? Like, oh, okay, Sally does. Okay, guess what, Sally? You won the initiative roll. I will also interject NPCs acting if it makes sense. Like the guy you just punched gets to punch you back now, and that kind of creates an obvious initiative order that makes sense to me. I keep soak in if it's literally people just kind of wailing on each other. I guess the biggest thing is I allow a lot of fast casting. I add the one difficulty, which if you give people a bunch of quintessence is really easy to counteract. If something is big, I will say, hey, I think that's going to take more than one round to accomplish, especially with the magic that you've laid out so far. I completely ignore structure, durability, and hardness. Mage is the only game, I think, in Old World of Darkness that has that.
Right, it has actual rules for it.
Yeah,
right.
Which is weird because, like, Vampire and Werewolf are the games where you have a strength of 14.
Right, you'd expect it to actually be more relevant.
Yeah. But the other thing I do keep is I keep health penalties, where as players go down their dice pool limits, not because I want the players to be necessarily weaker, but to me, it reinforces two key things. One, you're a meat sack. And two, you always get to use all of your magic. Like, Arete rolls do not suffer health penalties. And an Arete roll plus a willpower point lets you do a lot. And otherwise, I try and make situations escapable. I never want to force characters into the thing of like, oh no, you need to kill this guy or else. Right. One of the reasons that mages can last long is they often have the ability to leave in a way that other night folk may not have the ability to kind of slip the bonds of whatever they're dealing with. How do you do dice with online one-shots?
So I believe, a player. So if you want to roll physical dice in front of you at the computer, fine. If you're going to lie to me in a one shot in an online game, I don't care.
Yeah.
Good for you. Like, if you feel like that it is important for you to succeed in this task, I also agree with you. That said, I use Dice Maiden and other tools in Discord at times. And if people are more comfortable doing that, I'm okay with that. So to me, is as long as you have a way of rolling, use it. And again, I'm not checking players, but sometimes players feel more comfortable being checked. And if that's the case, then I definitely lean on the online, we can all see what you rolled sort of situation. And that can be fun.
The only weird piece of advice I have with online dice rollers is have a dice roller that gives you the individual die results.
Yes.
A lot of them will just give you the result of the roll. I think it builds a lot of tension when everyone can see the Dice Maiden roll and they can see the individual dice results and everyone kind of gets to count it together. I feel that builds suspense versus something that's like 8d10 diff 7 roll. Okay, 3 successes, moving on. I think it's a lot more fun to like see them, even if the dice are in order, especially if they're from small to large or something like that. And you're like 1-1 and you're like, oh crap. And then as you go towards the other side, you're like 8, 8, 9, 10. That is me. As dice pools increase in size, people seemingly spend more time shaking them, which I find absolutely infuriating. So sometimes I will say, please roll quickly. your dice don't get more random the more you shake them, but that's more of a pet peeve that I have.
I think, though, that people have that tactile reaction mm-hmm. to, they're moving in my hand, mm-hmm. I'm enjoying this, and then, yeah.
I will also quickly move around the table if someone isn't sure what they want to do, because to me, keeping everything moving is way more important than making sure that I adhere to an initiative system. Don't hesitate to have a NPC that takes 3 or 4 points of damage be knocked out or out or flee the scene. So we've talked about a bunch of mage stuff. Do you have any advice overall with how you run a one-shot that may apply to other games?
Yeah. The first thing is up the power rating of whatever you're doing. You mentioned this a little bit earlier, but absolutely, don't give people starting characters unless you are specifically playtesting starting characters. Give people characters that can do something in the world. Even when I ran the Familiars and Consorts one shot, they were not stock Familiars and Consorts. A couple, like one of them was a Paradox Spirit. And I gave that character powers that are impossible for a a player character to have in Mage. And that's okay. Do that. Have it be a little bit weird. Have them be a little bit more powerful. Players will enjoy it. That character will be more interesting and more memorable. And try and balance things too. Like, if one player is a matter master, then have another player be a life master. Don't have the same character have the same like powers and spheres, because that's going to be narratively boring really, really quickly.
Mage doesn't have, to me, a real strong expectation of what a stock game is. As long as your weird concept is something that you can deliver in two sentences or fewer, if it is your group of technocrats has been asked to clear out a haunted house, say that. That may not be a standard Mage game. If I generally recommend avoiding the Umbra, just because that is where the weirdness to me gets a little bit abstract. But a piece of the Umbra that has fallen into regular reality, maybe through a shallowing, I think that's a good kind of weird. Some sort of esoteric mage, or dealing with a revenant or something that otherwise, or a were jaguar or something, where it'd be like, there's a 1 in 10,000 chance of a mage ever encountering. It's a one shot deal with it.
In this game, you are going to engage with that. Yeah. Yes.
When I hand out the characters, if it turns out there is overlap sphere-wise, I say, hey, you two people, you both have life 3. Would you either A, like to specialize, or 2, would you just like to move any of those dots to something else? And sometimes that works and sometimes it doesn't. I generally give out a few wonders, and I modify wonders to just work. So if you have a portable hole or something that allows you to move from one point to another, I basically make it so the advantage of wonders and devices is they just work. And that is a good way of making sure that if there's something vital that needs to happen in the story, that it can happen. The other recommendation I have is start play as late into the plot as humanly possible. There are some games where the planning is the fun part, because that gives you something to do flashbacks to and so on. But if the goal of the group is to, if step one is to track down this book in Cairo, have everyone already in Cairo, or right, have everyone on the plane there, and ask them for justification. I try and give every character an opportunity to build background if they want to. So for my Justice Ascendant setting, I ask each character that when they're introducing their character, we go around, we say, what is your character's physical presentation? What are their pronouns? Because it's the World of Darkness, but no one will dead name you. Who was the person that really wanted them to do this, or really didn't want them to do this? And now that, as a storyteller, gives you someone to play with. It could be a spouse, it could be a kid, it could be a colleague, it could be a mentor, but it gives them buy-in as to why they are doing that. So if it's someone who doesn't want you to do it, that player now needs to provide a compelling reason why they are doing it anyway. And if it's someone who is pushing them to do it, why they think that is important. And that is a very fast way to have the character feel like they are already in the world. I have a lot of questions that I start out with to try and make the setting more evocative. Things like, is there another person in the group that you think you ran into before, and why? What is your character particularly curious about? What are their motives in doing this? Oh, my character wants to do it to prove that that the Babylonian gods are not dead and they have their favor. Or my character is doing it strictly for prestige. And that gives role-playing bits for the character to lean on. I try and have questions that I ask characters about each other in the course of play. So what does your character think about this other character's paradigm? So you're this highly technomantic person, and you just saw someone do a breathing exercise that allowed them to kick through a wall. What do you think that makes you feel like? I try and let characters get really into the weeds when it comes to describing what their effect looks like. Like, that's the closest we get to special effects in Mage. Like, there's no penalty or problem in saying, okay, as I do this chant to influence the room, blue sparks start to rise from the corners of my coat, the lights dim slightly. Like, why not? Just let them play into the drama. Add weird smells. What is a scar that your character has, and what is an interesting story behind it? This is the part where I just kind of steal from Powered by the Apocalypse and just say, what are some evocative questions that I could ask?
I was going to call you out on that, but you called yourself out. That's good. Yeah. The only thing that I do differently is I don't do any of that, insofar as what I do instead is provide three story hooks for each character and say, this is a thing that connects you to another character, connects you to an NPC, and connects you to the world at large. That's generally the framework that I try to build into every character backstory that I hand to a player in a one shot. They usually use pre-generated characters. Not always, but usually that's what I lean on. And I give them those three hooks as a way of then saying, these are things for me to think about and build into how I'm acting and reacting in the world. So I think it does similar stuff to what you're talking about by stealing those Powered by the Apocalypse type questions, but it is more on the storyteller end to help guide and control the direction of the story. You get to then expect that player B, who's playing Monica, who used to be in a relationship with Sylvester, the other character that is at the table, who is now a technocrat, and the tradition maids and the technocrat have this relationship tension, as well as the fact that they are on different sides of the Ascension War, that lets you kind of expect certain scenes that will occur in the game.
Are there any pitfalls that you feel that you've seen first-time storytellers kind of stumble into in running a one-shot?
This is a bus ticket kind of situation. Mm-hmm. If you don't have players that purchase a bus ticket and you don't know how to handle that, you'll have a bad time. It'll be okay, but you'll have a bad time because you usually have to hope that your players will buy a bus ticket and get on the plot bus and go along it. If they don't, you've got to improv a whole new story. And that can be really hard. And I've had it happen. Every new storyteller has it happen to them at one point or another. Either one player or the entire group would just be like, no, we're not biting. We're doing something else. If that happens, seed in parts of your original story into the background of the story that the players are trying to make you tell. They will either then turn around and buy a bus ticket, or they will turn around and let that inform the actions that they are trying to take on the story that they are hoping to experience. And one way or the other, you are using some of the things that you prepped in your game.
I think the two mistakes I get from storytellers that are first timers are, I set an internal clock that says, if the characters haven't said anything for 10 seconds, that is a sign that they are bored or confused and they need to do something. New GMs will often kind of write themselves into a corner. You're always allowed to have a person with a gun come in or a clue drop from nowhere, because sure, it kind of destroys quote unquote immersion, but that's not the goal of the one shot. Feel free to give a get out of jail free card or remind someone of a fact they would know, even indicate an action that a character takes without that player's permission. If it is subtle, it could be something Mage gives has the get out of jail free card in the form of the avatar, right? Like your avatar tugs at you to look at this with Force's vision or something like that. The other thing is, I think sometimes GMs set the price of failure too high in a one shot. It's great to have an epic story where you save the world, but basically what you're saying is you can't fail, and that story gets super unsatisfying if you don't finish in time, because you're like, oh, did we save the world? In the one shot I run, where I'm like, hey, here are four guys you could track down, everyone can track one person down in 4 hours. A lot of groups can do two. One try hard group did three and yelled at the fourth one. They're like, hey buddy, watch it, which is the closest I've gotten to somebody win. But like, when you set the stakes really high, you're telling the players they can't fail. Do you have any recommendations when you're making the one shot characters, when you're filling out those character sheets to produce a pre-gen?
Yeah. Give them reasons to interact with one another. I mentioned that before, but write them reasons to trust one another or feel slightly nervous about one another. Don't make them directly antagonistic, but find reasons to give them tension at the table. Just build those in, like that relationship issue, or maybe two players have the same mentor and the mentor liked one of them better than the other one. Like, build those into your character backgrounds and sheets that you provide them. And then that player can use that story to drive something happening.
Yeah. And make sure you either have it stated ahead of time or you get the character's permission. I build those things during character introduction where I say, is there another character in the group that you think your character has had a relationship with previously? Okay, you've listed this character. Other character, are you okay with that? No, I'm not okay with that. Okay, character-character romance is commonly a thing that gets X'd out in a one-shot, mm-hmm. so be prepared for that. But something like, what is the adventure you were on before that went south? Or what is the shared mentor experience? Or what is the geographic commonality that you have between? The nature of mage, to me, is one of those things where... So you have common things that you will encounter on a consent form. And mage is disproportionately likely to get into weird things that you didn't anticipate. The joke I have, which is not a joke, is whenever you're building a one-shot, make sure all children and dogs are invincible in your setting, because those are very common things that you will run into. One for me is make sure that your plot is not destroyed by a common thing that someone may not consent to. I, as a player, do not like mind control as a mechanic. I never give characters more than three dots of mind, where you can read someone's thoughts and maybe slightly influence their mood, but you can't get around in there and rearrange the furniture. Try and have a plot that is resilient to common difficulties players will have. And it may be something where something that you wanted to have front and center merely needs to be pushed off to the side. If a character has been harmed by someone else, you don't need to dwell on that. You can go very far through a mission, which I think is even more terrifying, where you leave that kind of blank. You can see signs of the horrendous deeds that were done in this room. That's kind of what I got. Any other thoughts, Josh?
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right about the kind of trigger issues and just being aware of not building your story around phobias, for example. Just try to not do that. Like, there are some common phobias. Don't have them be the center of your story. I think that's absolutely good advice. I think the other thing to do is to not build your story around something that you alone are interested in exploring. If you're like, I'm super hyped about this particular NPC or plot hook from X, Y, and Z book, unless you make everything that you are telling your players about beforehand, this is what this game is about, don't make it about this super esoteric element, because people are going to be like, I'm not into this. This is not interesting. But if you signpost it super early, like, this game is going to be about trauma, which one of my games was explicitly, I was like, this game is about trauma. And people were like, okay, I'm buying in. And even at the table before we played, I was like, this game is about trauma. Are you sure that you want to play this? And they were all like, yes, that's okay. But otherwise, don't make it something super like esoteric or specific or whatever, unless you sign notice.
If it's based on another property, say that up front. I stumbled into a game where if you were already familiar with the property it was based on, it was very clearly signposted to you what the game was about, because you're like, oh, I know that protagonist's name. I know the name of that magical effect. I just thought it was things that were baked into the default setting of the game, and it was not. And people were like, bloody blah would never say bloody blah to bloody blah. Don't you know anything about the setting? No, it's a one shot at Gen Con, right? And I've been drinking. And with that, if you're offering something at Triad Con, we thank you so much for doing that. If you're playing something at Triad Con, we thank you for doing that. There's a bunch of open spots. All the links are going to be in the show notes. Any last thoughts, Josh?
Go play games. Try them out. Run one shots. There are a lot of great online conventions right now. There are a lot of conventions that will be doing in-person stuff soon once we are all vaccinated and things like that. Please go run a one shot, play in a one shot. You'll enjoy it. It's the best way to play a game that you have wanted to play and never had the chance to.
One shots are like hitting on someone when you're single and traveling. You have the benefit that if it goes poorly, you never have to go there again. And if things go really well, you have a different set of problems, and that's on you. But still, give it a try. Josh, you're just coming off of a Kickstarter you finished. What other thing are you doing right now that you want to remind people that, oh, Josh Heath, many turned Josh, what is Josh doing now?
People should listen to Werewolf the Podcast. It is my primary podcast where I talk about Werewolf the Apocalypse. And I did just finish a Kickstarter for Devil Dice Island. Check that out when it comes out.
Awesome. Thank you so much. This has been Mage the Podcast, which recently got vaccinated. I'm not sure against what or with what, as it's a podcast, is only a few years old, and has no physical form, but still, its arm is a little sore. The show is made possible by executive producers who include Anders S., Andrew K., Andrew E., Brendan, Bryce Perry, Christopher P., Chris Zach, Ira Grace, Jenna F., Justin B., John H., John Magnuson, Josh Goulden, Michael Parker, Richard Bat Brewster, William C., William M., Jay Suncern, Andy, Dan Svensson, Neil Patterson, Buck Farmer, Isabel Castillo Lopez, and Michael Creedle. Our EP shout-out this week is to Andy, who, from what I gather from their participation in our Discord, seems to live somewhere in Australia. And I wanted to use this opportunity to mention something I only recently learned, which I don't think I've shared yet on the show. The most venomous to human spiders known is the male Sydney funnelweb spider, whose venom contains Delta atracotoxin, which is an ion channel inhibitor that makes it remarkably deadly to primates. Other mammals are unaffected by this toxin largely. And just remember, there's no native primates in Australia. So it's so venomous, it had extra venom to kill things that it hadn't encountered yet. Anyway, Andy, thanks for your support, and I hope you can find an awesome age game. If you'd like to become an executive producer just like Andy, get a chat color in Discord and a number of other benefits, click on Become a Supporter in the show notes or through the episode entries on our webpage. If you super liked this episode or super didn't, drop us a line at maidsthepodcast@gmail.com or at maidsthepodcast on Twitter. We read every message. We have a Hop in Discord community at discord.me/maidsthepodcast. Join the conversation there. You can subscribe to our show on Spotify, Anchor, TuneIn, iTunes, Google Play Podcasts, or the podcatcher of your choosing. If you like us, please give us a review on the platform of your choice or tell a friend about us. Also, go to maidsthepodcast.com for show notes and all of our previous shows. Now go change reality. Bye.